Hey everybody, how's it going? Dan Schinder here with...
Steven Schinder.
And our guest, third time offender, third or fourth? Fifth time offender? Major offender, Trevor Rabin. Welcome again. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Good. It seems like we're traveling through the weirdest time warp. First of all, I can't believe it's Thursday already. I can't believe it's May 9th already. But what about 30 years of talk? Can you personally get your head around that?
It is. I mean, it seems as though it was not that long ago. But it definitely was, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think about, since I did that, I've done 50 films and dozens of TV shows and, you know, NBA themes and what have you, and an album.
Yeah.
It kind of makes a little bit of sense.
Right. And let's think back to the recording process. We mentioned briefly on another episode that this is probably the very first album to be completely recorded to hard disk. And I remember reading way back then a little bit of frustration you had, but can you talk about, was there a learning curve or how did you prepare for it? How did you decide this is how we're going to do it? And how did you explain that to the rest of the band? Can you talk about that process?
Yeah, when the record company, as essentially Phil Carson, came and asked me to produce basically Yes West, there was no music or anything at the time, and so there was time to go through a bit of a process. And I thought, you know, I've got 24 track machines, I've got a Dash 24 track Sony, and we could do it that way, but we're on the cusp of this new technology taking place. And unfortunately, at the time, it was one Macintosh with the program I was using, which was Digital Performer. It was four tracks. You could only do four tracks. So Mike Jay, who was a guy who was working with me, a technical guy, said, well, we can link up four Macintoshes and link them to the 24 track if there's anything we want to do with that. So it was a bit of a nightmare. And then we can do four tracks on one Mac, and we can do tracks on another Mac, and then we can transfer those to another Mac in stereo. And there were four Macs, so we had 16 tracks. And I tell you, there were literally times when people from MIT somewhere in Boston sent guys with white coats out here to sit and write down things for codes to change. So it was really on the precipice, you know. It was right in the beginning of this whole thing, and there were definite difficulties, but the band were very patient, which was great, because I tried to explain the benefits of doing this. You could do a take and you don't have to wipe the take and take another track. You can just keep doing it until you get the right performance. It wasn't really fully understood, because I didn't fully understand it. I don't think really anyone did. But I was really happy that we landed up finishing it and figuring out how to do it. I remember I went to like a little resort to meet John, because I thought John and I need to get on the page together on this. And we had a great time down there, wrote a bunch of stuff. Funnily enough, I don't think any finished thing or anything came from that writing session we had down there, but it didn't matter. We'd created a really great vibe, and I can't remember when I did it, but when I first wrote Silent Spring, going into Endless Dream and that whole suite, I just kind of started and ended, and it was like, well, I guess I'm done. And then obviously Chris came and played, and Alan, and I'd done a bunch of backing, you know, the vocals that I do on the song.
Yeah.
I'd done that, and John and Damien, his son, I said, I've got something to play, and they came to the studio, and I basically played the whole of Endless Dream from beginning to end, and I thought, it's kind of strange piece of music, nothing like we've done before, but I'm feeling good about it, and came to the end of it, and I turned round, and John and Dame were crying.
Oh, wow. It was that bad? No, I'm kidding.
That's what I thought, okay, this is good or really bad, right? And John said that's one of the best things, and couldn't wait to get his teeth into writing some lyrics and putting some putting his stamp on it. And I think that I can't remember the scheduling of when things happened, but I remember that really clearly. And then every song had its moment. It was amazing. You know, Real Love, Chris just had this riff, this dun 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 dun, and that was it. And we had to build from that, and John wrote some, you know, his usual, you know, kind of the lyrics, which were kind of abstract but very cool.
Yeah.
And it's so long ago, it's hard to remember all the little bits and pieces. I do remember getting frustrated, being in the middle of something and saying, this isn't transferring over, what's going on? And suddenly a lot of discussion with the two guys in the back and phone calls to Massachusetts and rewriting codes and then sending it back again. It was definitely at the cusp.
Like the digital version of bouncing, you know, exactly. When we had the old reel-to-reels and you'd bounce to add tracks, kind of the coding version of that, right?
Right. And then there'd be phase problems and, there were all kinds of issues, but I love it. I think it was worth it. I mean, it has such a different sound to the previous records. And
yeah. Definitely. Did anyone at any time say, can we just roll some tape? Can we just turn that wash machine thing on with the two reels on it? Like, did it ever get to that point where it got that frustrating? It was like, just go back to ground zero.
Well, John was very patient. I don't really remember, but the person I would think who would have done that would be my absolute brother, and that would be Chris Squire. He said, oh God, what's going on? I said, don't worry. So I'm sure there was a bit of that.
Yeah, I remember seeing interviews from back in the day, you know, looking up like what people post on YouTube and whatnot. And there was a moment where John said, this is the album I've been waiting for. What do you think he meant by that?
You know, Big Generator, I think, as you know, was a difficult thing. It was, you know, it was in Italy, and it was, John was really not on the outs, but I don't think was enjoying much of it. And he came up with the name Big Generator, and he was really into it. And then things in Italy didn't pan out as we wanted, even though I think at the end of the day, there's some good stuff on Big Generator that I'm proud of. But it led to this album being something that we really got close on. And ironically, that feeling of camaraderie stayed throughout the album, but nothing we actually did from when we were at this beach at motel thing, which was such fun with John. I don't think much happened from there, but the attitude definitely did.
Yeah, that's great. The production, I mean, the music's great, of course, and there's so many individual elements that really stand out. One of them is that version of the Yes Choir is just amazing, and the way the album opens up with that is great. But the production is at the absolute other end of the spectrum from Big Generator. I mean, with all due respect, the music's great on Big Generator, but it sounds like it's in a cardboard box compared to what you did with Talk. It's just a whole different world. And I think it validated that process that you went through.
You know, I couldn't have said it better than that. It's it validated doing it that way. And with all the pain and the you know, the hiccups throughout, technical hiccups, it was all worth it, because it's a very different sounding record to 90125 or Big Generator or Talk, or what's the other one? Onion is recorded.
Onion, yeah.
Onion, which I get to this day hear the whole thing.
Right. So with Talk, was there any particular track that was a bit more challenging to work on than the rest, either from a writing perspective or a production perspective?
I think the whole of Endless Dream and the three kind of not really independent parts, although Silent Spring's called a new
the movements, if you will.
Yeah, it's all Endless Dream, but you know, the time signatures and that, and then going in and then bringing back the the piano part, which is where I started with that.
Right.
And it's funny, I was singing. I don't know if you remember the "Held Your Head Up High," you know. I was singing that over when I first wrote that. I was singing it over the piano part, and playing that with the right hand, but playing the chords on the left hand. And I thought, oh, that's really busy. So then I made it into what it became.
Yeah, and it's great that this album is getting its due with this 30th anniversary re-release, because I feel like with the Yes catalog, once it gets past the Atlantic era, you know, once it goes past Big Generator, there are some albums after that that don't really get as much re-release or exposure. Like you said, you know, Union is Union, so there's that. But Talk is, you know, it's such a favorite among Yes fans. Like, you see a lot of great comments from people, and you see, like, how much it means to them. So it's great that it's back in the spotlight, so to speak.
No, I'm happy about it. I've had... It just on the Facebook stuff, it's why can I not get Talk on Spotify or this, or where's Talk? And so I'm glad it's available. There's a couple of things which shouldn't have been done, but it's arrogant record company, without really checking with anything, they've taken as one of the pieces that they do on the extra tracks or whatever, you know, the bootleg nonsense and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
They've taken, I did an instructional video for Starlix 1,000 years ago. And in the beginning, they said, can you jam some? So I put something on the computer, kind of jazzy thing that I could play along to, and they filmed me playing along to this backtrack on acoustic guitar, and they lifted the sound off that and put it on the record, and I said, I don't even own this, I can't say yet.
Is that instrumental thing is referred to? We were going to ask you about that.
Untitled Raven instrumental.
Yeah, exactly. And it's
weird.
The opening thing of the instructional video on Starlit.
Publishing
is owned by Hal Leonard. I have nothing to do with it.
So, and it's not part of the Talk sessions or any of that whatsoever.
Exactly. Oh, no, not at all. And I wrote to them and said, you have to remove this stuff. And and there was one other thing, was I've had no masters to check, because they said it's been remastered. This shouldn't be remastered. There's a whole process I would like to do with remastering this. I don't want Omnisphere, no 5.1, forget about that. This was done specifically as a complete digital extravaganza, in my mind anyway, and in stereo, you know, the last bastion of, anyway, but you know, these things go on all the time.
Yeah, but I want to interject and tell you, Trevor, that I'm on board with what you just said. I think I'm really old fashioned in some ways when it comes to music. Don't say anything, Steve. And whenever I hear that there's remastered versions of stuff, to me, I'm going to use Yes songs as an example. Yes songs, the original pressing of that on vinyl and however else it came out, to me, that's a slice of history of how things were done with what there was to utilize to create that recording.
Absolutely.
And I see the same thing with talk. It was done, like you said, as a digital extravaganza in stereo with that technology that was really on the precipice of coming out and changing how things would be done. Why fuck around with it? It represents that. It'd be like saying, let's take the Declaration of Independence and, you know, let's change the font and make it easier to read. Like, what? It's the same thing.
It is exactly the same thing. I mean, it's incredible. Talk is a stereo record and done at the height of what we could do at the time. Yeah. And to now say, how about an Omnisphere version? Or how about, Omnisphere to me is... it's a load of crap. It screws with the phase of everything, and you can have one bar. And, you know, to me, you know, with 50 movies and on, you know, a lot of it was done in Omnisphere, and I understand it fully. And a lot of movies there before was done in, you know, 5.1 or sometimes 5.2. In fact, I did a ride at Epcot where it was 7.2, so very specific placements of speakers, and you sit and you basically take the space shuttle to Mars. That's the idea of it. But the cool thing is, and I had to have in the studio a transducer speaker, which takes everything from 50 hertz down and just basically rattles your bum, you know?
Yeah.
And a very cool idea, but not something to make a record with. It's like,
right, and it doesn't work anyways unless you have the setup.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I've heard some Omnisphere things on some crappy Omnisphere TVs, or you know, and it's not great, you know. To me, it's still the old-fashioned 5.1 with a subwoofer, with you know, cut off at the right. Don't cut yourself off at 30 hertz and just have rumblings at the bottom. Bring it up a bit, you know, and then I don't know. I think people are trying so hard to come up with new ways of presenting music, and 9 times out of 10, it's crap.
I agree.
When he said Omnisphere, at first I thought he said ominous fear. So like, there you go.
Yeah, it is pretty ominous fear.
Yeah. There's also these instrumental versions of some of the talk tracks on this track list. And some people were wondering if any of that was from the Yes Active CD-ROM. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't received it. I've read it and I've complained about it. And I've said, can't you just release the record as it was, exactly as it was? And, oh, yeah, no, we are doing that. I said, well, I'd like to hear it. And they've been very forthcoming and apologetic and everything. Mm. And then these bootlegs and all this other stuff on it. I don't know why it can't just be this one record. And
without all the extras, yeah.
Yeah, and the Starlex thing, it was literally me with a couple of microphones playing back what I programmed onto the studio, and then playing acoustic solo back on it. And I don't even know what it was recorded on, probably a DAT. I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, it's the worst quality, but it was fine for the video or the DVD. But it was just, you know, the beginning of the video had some funny shirt I had on. They had that going, you know, like up art and Roger Deanish kind of thing, and then onto my fingers playing the solo, and now it's on a record. It was never meant to be on a record.
Interesting. If that's for me, I'm not here. We'll circle back to 30 years ago in a moment. I'm curious if you know whether or not, A, is there any in-studio, in-production pictures or anything like that with this box set, and does any video exist anywhere of that recording process at all?
You know, it's very sad. Mike Jay, who was fantastic and who did kept everything and documented everything, and did it with me. He actually was on the road with us in Japan on, I think, 90125, or yeah, I think. He's just a brilliant guy. I think he's mostly doing music editing right now for film. But he had document. You know, I had a console called, what did I have? A Soundcraft, then I updated to a really nice console with flying faders and everything. And we utilized that within all this digital newness. And that board has since gone because it's obsolete. You know, you can do everything on a laptop now.
Yeah.
And so the funny thing is, if someone said to me, you have to set up to remix this, the console I actually donated to my son's school, and I was horrified to see it sitting outside in the rain about 2 years later at the school. It's brilliant board. So, but I don't know where it is now.
Again, a piece of history, you know, even with gear.
Oh, absolutely. And it was such a brilliant board. API? I can't remember. But yeah, it was a brilliant setup how it had been done. And every single thing, there must have been, I think Mike still has the 50 pages of, first thing, 1K, 3 dB, such and such, such and such, compression, blah, 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 blah. Every single channel had that. That went on page after page. He's still got that, but we have no way, short of getting that board back and having it done in the same way. And my studio has since been rewired completely. And the guy who wired the system up is brilliant. And I think he's retired.
Interesting. Going back 30 years again, when the album, well, before I ask the when the album was done question, how big was this hard drive system? Like nowadays, I'm looking at one of my external drives that the cord won't reach, but it's like the size of half a graham cracker and twice as thick, and it's like 4 terabytes. Was it 4 Macs that you were bouncing between, and were there big external drives, like as big as a refrigerator? What was it?
It was under size, and not to mention that if we were saving some stuff, it would be like, okay, we can go to bed now, it'll be finished by the time we get back to the studio in the morning. So it would take so long. It was really tedious. It was like ox-driven.
Like a vegetable cart?
ox carts driven digital. It was definitely the beginnings. When I think of what we used to do then and what I had to do then compared to what I'm doing now, that album could have taken a lot less time, but I don't think it would have been the same. There was something about having that time and saying, you know what, I've got 40 minutes to sit around doing nothing. Maybe I should rearrange that part of the calling, and that whole thing in the middle I completely rearranged from a piece I had that I was going to be using in a film. It became so much part of the calling.
So that's then, interesting.
So yeah. Which bit was that, that
like the musical to? Bridge da, 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 like all that
yes.
part? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Does that like change key every couple or three bars or something like that? Or is it just the scale that it's
completely transitioning?
Yeah.
Which I think is it Ravel who does that? And I can't remember. It's so early for me. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff I did on that, you know, with chord changes and in the interim period of Endless Dream, that, where did that idea came from? Well, it were chords that I thought would work really well with it. And then when I went back, I think it was either Debussy or Dvorak who'd done something similar. And I thought, oh, shit, it's not that original. And then I thought, No, but I heard it first. Yeah, but he lived 50 years before you did, or 100 years before.
Yeah.
I claim.
So going back when the album was done, did you, how much consideration, if any, went of the live sound you were going to tour with went into the production of the album, or was it the other way around? When the album was done, it was like, okay, now we got to produce the live sound as best we can, or was that, was there any curve to get that done, or was it just, we're going to go out and play it the way we play it?
I think initially, and I can't remember if it was a Big Generator or the Talk album, but the idea was do the album, then go on the road. This was just talking points, I guess, with managers and stuff. Go on the road and then do it live, and then use the live version for the actual record. Don't release the actual recording of the record, which obviously was not something we did. Right. It was one of those things where I remember we had a meeting after 90125 because we'd had a plane for the band, because, you know, I had my spleen thing happen, so there was plenty of time to realize how the tour was going to do.
Yeah.
And Chris was very happy that we could charter a plane, which we did, and came to meetings about Big Generator. Now there's, we don't know how it's going to do. So the manager said, Chris, guys, I need to have a meeting. And we had a meeting, and I might have told you the story, but if I have, stop me.
Yeah, go ahead, for those who haven't heard it.
I think I may have heard this somewhere, but it's so funny that it's worth repeating. Yeah.
Okay, and so the manager said, look, we'll go commercial air, and it'll be fine, and, you know, we can still do it first class and everything, but I don't think there's the budget as yet. We haven't seen what it would mean to charter a plane. And Chris said, well, what if the album does as well as the last one? We'll have gone commercial for nothing. And I just cracked up, and I thought, oh, that is Chris.
That is so funny.
Yeah.
And I saw the show, I may have told you this, I saw the show at the Greek Theater. And right. If you remember, I don't know if it was the whole tour or just in LA and certain cities, but they did the simulcast where you could rent these special headphones and listen to the radio broadcast of what you guys were doing on stage. And I was like, why would you do that? Like, why would someone sit in the audience and listen to that when you can have your hair blown back by what was going on stage? And that, which I chose to do. And
right.
I just thought that was so odd. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I had quite a lot of bad ideas, and I was just trying to push it as far as possible. It was also in quad, if you remember, the whole show.
I do.
Was in quad.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, for the people sitting up front, where if Chris is way on that side of the stage,
makes sense.
Yeah, it you could get more of a cohesive mix for yourself, and you'll still get the boof boof coming from stage, but your headphones will at least give you some more of a coherent, cohesive sound of the whole band. But
that never occurred to me back then. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it worked. I listened to it for a while, and it was like, I think it works. And I can't remember who I was working with to do this, but I was determined that Talk also lifted the live thing, so that the and Quad wasn't new, but at least it was an extra added thing, so that there was something juicy to use for the live show.
Right. Now, CDs had already come out, of course, and
right.
By then, as listeners, you know, the average listener, I think, pretty much could tell the difference between the digital CD sound versus a vinyl pressing, you know, the difference in warmth and everything like that.
Yes.
Talk, given the process that you used, does have a lot of warmth and a lot of bottom. How much conscious effort went into that to make it not sound like just when CDs were new?
Yeah, I would painstakingly, because I know what we went through on Big Generator, because the Dash 24-track Sonys, what do you call it? The A to D converters, and that were still pretty harsh. So, and at the end, it was using a lot of analog to try and overcome that. But with talk, there was the only analog was just little bits and pieces we had to use. It was essentially an album done on four Macintoshes and bounced between each other, and it was very carefully EQ'd. So the harshness was kept at bay, because in order to get something to punch that you normally would add to a snare drum, like 1.4K or something, and that would give you a bit more of a clucky bang. With this format, you could pull back on that and allow the warmth to envelop the whole mix. And doing that bit by bit actually warmed up the entire mix. And yes, it's still a digital album, but it doesn't sound too harsh. I find it to this day to sound quite inviting.
Yeah, absolutely. I have one more question regarding that, and then Steve has questions, I'm sure, about the material. And then I want to talk about the album cover. But since you did that, Trevor, back then, how much has that process been improved upon, but how much may have been lost in elements of fidelity upon those improvements, if that makes any sense? The improvements of technology, has anything been lost fidelity-wise in that process because of that?
I think just creatively, things have become so easy. Mm-hmm. So some of the quirky things that one would do to try and arrive somewhere, those things just seem to come. And I don't think there's the same passion in trying to achieve those things as there might have been in the past.
That makes sense, yeah.
Okay. Now for the tour, I thought there was like a really great representation of the album, you know, almost every song, but I don't think State of Play was ever played live. What was it, a bit challenging trying to figure out how to do that? Was it actually considered?
You know, it was a bit like I'm Running. You know, the one thing about Yes, and this is it's a lovable complaint, but I don't think the band ever rehearsed to a point where we got through the entire show because of, I don't know if it was laziness or, I'll be at rehearsal a little later, I'm just going for dinner. I don't know what it was, but we never were able to say, okay, we're still three songs shy of finishing the show. We've got to finish the show before we actually perform it. We've got to rehearse it. Never did we go on stage having rehearsed the entire thing start to finish. And consequently, songs like I'm Running, which was one of the songs I so wanted to do from Big Generator, that we did, I think, twice, and it was such a mess because we just didn't know it.
And that's one of my favorite songs on that album, too. That's a great piece of work.
And there were a lot of overdubs to consider, and it was just so difficult to organize. So we did it a couple of times, and it didn't work. And then State of Play was another one. We just, no one ever knew it. And it was like, all right, well, you know, we've got 90% of the album. We're in good shape. So I think Yes's live shows were rehearsed to being 100% correct after about 10 days or so of being on the road.
Right.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, at that time in 94, I don't think a vinyl release was as much of a concern, but you still had like cassette in mind, you know, side A, side B and whatnot. Were there any, I know this was so long ago, but were there any like different considerations for how the track list should be, like different order or anything like that?
Well, as you say, there was the A side and the B side, and that became the standard.
Right.
So, but yeah, for streaming, I guess it goes through the same thing, right? It's just A side, B side, right, right. The interesting thing is, you know, I just did this album, Rio, and the record sent me, you know, albums and CDs. And I've said to people who've said, oh, I'd love to hear your CD. And I said, oh, no problem. And I said, here's a CD. Said, oh, I don't have a CD player. I need to download it. No one has anything to play anything on anymore.
Yeah. I actually bought a, let's see if it'll reach. I have an external CD player that I can plug into my PC via USB, because I've got all these CDs and stuff and nothing to play it on. Not even my laptops have CD players anymore.
Yeah, these days I have to use my old PlayStation 3 to play CDs.
And newer cars don't have them, you know? It's all MP3 or USB to your phone or Bluetooth or whatever. It's really weird how that futuristic mode of listening to music has pretty much disappeared, you know? Mode that in my mind ruined album covers, because it was all so shrunk down, you know? I have this handy to read CDs and stuff.
Oh my goodness,
it's crazy. Talking about, you know, covers and whatnot, how did the Peter Max element come into the fold? Was that a band decision, a record company decision? How did that come about?
It was Phil Carson and our manager, Tony Dimitriadis, thinking of, I always want the cover to be really simple. And I think that was a general thing of how the Yes West were going to be simple covers. And when Peter Max's name came up, I thought, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then I think he just scribbled in the back of a limousine or something, handed it into his office, and they did it. And we just said, that'll work.
Wow, that's awesome.
It was kind of as simple as that. And we thought, okay, Peter, the name of the album is Talk. I remember going through his office in New York. It was almost like going through Hans Zimmer's, we call it the Walmart of film scoring. You know, there's just a little box of 50 different composers that nobody knows, but sit in the box making these things. It was the same at Peter Max's place, just tons of these illustrators, very talented people doing this stuff. And I guess it went through that rigmarole and came out with the cover.
That's interesting. It was a flashback for me, because the name Peter Max was synonymous with my like first, second, and third grade book covers my mother would buy me. They were all Peter Max art. So this is back in the early 70s, like maybe 70 through 73, or before then. I can't even do the math in my head, but Peter Max was quite popular back then, where he even had a line of book covers for
school. Yellow Submarine, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, no, he was quite the guy, and he had such a specific style. And I think he utilized it. You can still see it's a Peter Max, illustration, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. Do you have any favorite memories of the tour?
I just remember how well the band was playing on that tour. And many times Chris would be on the plane or on the bus on the way to Santiago in Chile, saying, shit, you know, maybe this is an album that we should really get someone to record this really well, because we're playing it well. And if it's recorded well, we could then have a really legitimate live album of this.
Oh, yeah.
And we never did it, but I still on YouTube. It's funny, Lee Pomeroy, the guy who played with ARW, great bass player.
Yeah.
He pointed out to me, he says, oh, I love the little beginning thing you do on Hearts in Chile. I said, I do? What did I do? He said, well, you, Chris, Alan, and Tony do a whole thing in the beginnings. And it's like, oh, I didn't know that. I don't even remember playing that ever.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. And there's so many of those little things from this tour. And it's like, wow, those things would be great to if they'd been included on the album.
Yeah.
And then Endless Dream doesn't sound too good in Chile, but there's a lot of magic on how it's being performed. You can see how much we're enjoying it.
Yeah,
like you definitely see the energy of everyone involved there.
I think we really love doing that tour.
Yeah. I'm gonna
John, in particular, John was just so happy because to him, we'd visited an area which had been kind of some, he was glad that there were these songs which were, you know, you could sit down halfway through them,
yeah,
and the song is still going on, you know, because they were much longer and took their time. I think he liked that aspect.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to read a few comments real quick from earlier. Amy David Valentine, I believe, said Talk is an uplifting album. I definitely agree. I think this is John Perez from Close to the Yes USA Tribute Band. It says, to me, Talk is very much a masterpiece. It's at the level of Going for the One. Love it.
That's great.
Yeah, that's high praise. And Tori Morton Andreasen Figenschow, I hope I pronounced that correctly, wants to know a bit more about the guitars, amps, and pedals used.
My goodness. I think I still was using, amp-wise, it was Ampeg 120 VTs I used, as well as using just Line 6 plug-in things. A lot of it was directly plugged in and utilizing the technology that was available. My pedal board was something I put together with Bob Bradshaw. So I was still using the Bob Bradshaw pedal board, which had basically something that's put together with pedals I've loved all my life. So the pedals from 1968 and very old stuff that have been cleaned up so they're not as noisy, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, which is sometimes a problem because he gets rid of the noise. And I said, it doesn't sound the same. He said, well, then do you want that junk in there? I said, yes, please.
Yeah, that's interesting. On that note, something just occurred to me while you were just describing that, going back briefly to the whole technology you were using. What was the interface from mic'd amps and the board to the digital side of things? What was the interface? What translated the information?
Well, the interface was the Macintosh interface, and there'd be the A to D converter and the
D to D converter.
Okay. And those are hugely improved at this point, but I think because they were pretty basic in those days, it gets to your point of how did you EQ the stuff and how did you manipulate the stuff so there was a softness, or an attempt at kind of filtering out some of the harshness which inherently comes with the old A to D's and D to A's.
Right. Thanks. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, I wish there was video of this whole process being done and the whole set.
Yeah, no.
The guys from MIT and NASA in their white coats with the meat thermometer, the pocket protector, and the air pressure thing, and the highlighter, and whatever was used.
It would have been a great movie because it was nuts. I mean, it was completely nuts what we were doing. We didn't think it was nuts at the time. It's like, well, I guess this is what you do if you want to record digitally. And I remember doing a talk in LA for Macintosh. And it's funny, my son and Ryan and Shelley was there. And they came to me afterwards and said to me, you're not a great talker. And I said, well, what did I say? I thought I talked all right. I said the right things. And they said, yes, if you just pulled out. Every second word is And Peter Gabriel was there, and he walked up to me and he said, "Rather you than me, mate."
Yeah. He's a lot of umaros. Yeah,
No,
absolutely.
yeah, I've that issue too, still to this day, after even years of like doing all these video things, I still have in my speech. So I think we're at a point where people just sort of roll with it for the most part.
Oh yeah, no, listen, I'm not a Barack Obama. It's not my highlight to speak. I rather sing, but I did put my point across to them. Although some of them, I think, got a little bored because it went on and on.
Funny.
Talk is very cinematic. Do you ever watch any films? I don't know if you ever think this, but do you ever watch a film and think, oh, this track from Talk would fit really well with this scene? Like, does that ever come up when you're watching anything?
I would say it could, because it is very cinematic, but having done 50 films, I think I've probably got a substitute for what that thought would be on the 50 I've done, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Well, great. Thanks for taking time to share these memories that are 30 years old. It's just crazy that the album, amazing. It still sounds so modern, and it could come out today. Well, it is coming back out, but I mean, it could come out for the first time and be relevant and not sound dated. It doesn't sound dated at all. And I think that speaks a lot to, you know, what the accomplishment is, not just on the production side, but musically as well, with the whole band and the writing and everything.
I think it was a really good moment, and I have to thank you guys for reminding me of stuff that I'd forgotten about, and and the depth in which you go into these things. Because
thanks.
Yeah, it's like I'm talking to Mike Jay, who's the engineer on it.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you taking time. Stay on the line with us, and folks, thank you so much for joining Stephen, Trevor, and myself here on Drum Talk TV and Yes Shift, talking about 30 years of the album Talk and the reissue. And you can follow us at Yes Shift, at facebook.com/YesShift and youtube.com/@YesShift and on anchor.fm/YesShift. And Steve will tell you how you can send us hate mail if you want, right, Steve?
Yeah, you can email us at yesshiftpodcast@gmail.com with feedback, comments, and whatever. And yeah, again, thanks to anyone tuning into this.
Yeah, and Trevor, where can they follow you online?
No one's here to help me, but I've got there's a Facebook Trevor Rabin fans, and there's another one.
Trevor Rabin Music.
You can help me with that. I'm not too familiar.
We'll put it all in the notes.
Okay, great.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you soon.
All right. Great talking to you guys.
Thanks.